This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Stephen Elliott ran away from an abusive father when he was 13. He spent several years as a ward of the state of Illinois, moving from group home to group home. He used drugs, was often truant. He failed his first 2 years of high school, but at the age of 16, he decided to turn his life around. Stephen Elliott is a graduate of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and Northwestern University. Last year, he was awarded the 2001 Stegner Fellowship at Stanford University. The two-year fellowship is offered to writers in fiction and poetry. Stephen Elliott is the author of a book based on his experiences, the title, A Life Without Consequences. The book is a work of fiction about kids living in institutions and group homes in Illinois. It's his second novel. The first, Jones Inn, was published by Boneyard Press. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. A Life Without Consequences is published by McAdam Cage Publishing. And again, our telephone number is 333-9455. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Stephen Elliott, good afternoon. Greetings from Champaign-Urbana.
Hey, thanks a lot.
How are you?
Oh, pretty good. A little under the weather today.
Oh. Well, I hope you'll feel better soon.
Yeah, there's a flu bug going around out here.
Yeah.
But, no, good enough for sure.
Well, tell us, let's start at the beginning. What led you to leave home? You were 13 years old.
Yeah, it was, a pretty standard abusive household. And my mother was very ill. And at the point when she passed away, I left the way I always knew that I would. So, I left and slept on rooftops and such for a year. And then after about a year, I was arrested sleeping in a hallway, and the state took custody of me. My father had actually moved in the meantime, so I didn't know where my father was. So that's what prompted the ward of the court proceedings.
So your life and the life of the protagonist storyteller in A Life Without Consequences pretty much mirror one another, I'm guessing.
It's a pretty autobiographical book, but at the same time, I was recognizing that there's so many memoirs out there and that everybody has a hard childhood in some way. And so I wanted to do more than just say, here's my story. So I wrote this fiction in order that I can make it more enjoyable for readers. I could add, plot elements, give it an arc, a necessary dramatic arc. Well, at the same time, educating people about these places where children go, these group homes, where wards of the court, kids are in the bottom of that ladder with no advocates, where they go in the system. And that's the point of the book.
Yeah. Well, it's a real eye-opener for those of us who have never been in the system and who know very little about the system. You have a scene in the book where the protagonist, Paul, is looking for a friend of his, Tanya. And Tanya, he believes, may be in prison. So he goes to juvenile hall. Do you have the book there with you?
Mm-hmm.
Turn to page 117, and maybe you would read your description of the place for us there. Because that's one scene that comes to mind immediately that's an eye-opener for how the system
works. The first paragraph?
Yeah.
The juvenile hall is located at 1100 South Hamilton, 6 stories high, 2 more stories deep, 2 blocks from Little Italy, 2 blocks from the University of Illinois, and 2 blocks from the end of the line. I walk to the metal detector. I have nothing in my pockets. In front of me, the juvenile courts, up the stairs, the jail. A concrete statue stands in the middle of the floor depicting a man pushing a boulder. A guard passes, gives me a look. A lady, eyes wide with crack and hair sticking up to the ceiling, walks by, dragging a little girl by the wrist. little girl is a victim of the Family First policy pushed by the Department of Children and Family Services. The stairs lead up to the cells. The hallways lead to the courtrooms, rows of them, but children are not allowed in the courts. The kids have to sit on the benches outside while their cases are heard inside, and the DCFS workers and the judge and the guardian ad litem make the decisions that will determine their future. If they ever let us speak in court, they would hear some crazy things. The whole building would probably come down. Children and parents are everywhere. The court is crowded. They sit on benches or lean against the walls.
If they ever let us speak in court, they would hear some crazy things. The whole building would probably come down.
Yeah.
Should children in state custody have the opportunity to address the court?
Oh, absolutely. As far as I'm concerned. I mean, what you have, you know, there's a great organization called CASA. I don't know if you're aware of it. It started in 1984, but it wasn't around when I was in the court system.
It's active here. Tell us about it.
Yeah, CASA, it's a volunteer group. Basically, people get assigned to a child, and they speak on the child's behalf in court. They're an adult speaking for the child, a court-appointed special advocate. The thing is, not every kid has a CASA, because they always need more volunteers. And CASA wasn't in Illinois at the time that I was in the courts. And what happens is, in court, you have somebody representing DCFS. And what they're really doing is they're representing the state, the state's interests, the Department of Children and Family Services, so that they don't look bad. You know, then you might have somebody representing the parent. You might have a guardian ad litem for the child, or you might not. But at any rate, but even the guardian ad litem doesn't actually know the child. You know, might meet the child for a couple of minutes prior to entering the courtroom. So there's, you have somebody advocating for the parent, somebody advocating for the state, but you have nobody advocating for the child. And this is why, you know, children just get left. They get stuck in places that aren't good fits for them. You know, there's places where you just shouldn't end up if you have an advocate, where you probably wouldn't end up with an advocate.
Yeah. Now, why can't kids be on the inside while the cases are decided?
Well, I don't know. I think it's terrible.
Even if you're not allowed to speak, it seems to me at the very least you ought to be able to be there on the inside.
You know, constitutional rights have been decided that they don't apply to children. You know, so children have no rights. There's nobody legally looking out for children's rights. Not really, not as individuals. You know, the Constitution doesn't apply to them. Nobody needs to press charges if they commit a crime. All sorts of things, you know. They can get held without bail hearings and so forth. And, you know, the children just have no rights. So the courts are set around what's most convenient for the adults.
You write in the book, Paul tells us, the character, the protagonist, the main storyteller, he tells us about how this world is so hidden. Group homes are funny places, he says, and he talks over and over again about how secret everything is. Why do you suppose there is so little awareness of the situation?
I don't know, and that was really important to me in writing the book, was to tell people that, you know, they might be two doors down from a group home. They don't even know about it. I mean, the state doesn't publicize them. They don't want people to know. The children don't want people to know that they're in group homes. They're ashamed of it. Many of the group homes have their own schools, so the group home children don't even interact with the rest of the population. They go to these schools that are really the equivalent of holding pens, you know, babysitters. They don't learn anything. And people just are totally unaware, you know, of the 100,000 children or so that are stuck in the system, you know, below the foster parents, you know, the kids that don't get adopted. Nobody knows what happens to them.
Well, there are foster homes. What are the other options for children with problems? You mentioned group homes.
Yeah, it pretty much goes, you know, you can get adopted, you can go into a foster home, you can go into a specialized foster home, which is like a group home, except that there's somebody there with a foster parent's license who might stay there 4 days a week, 4 days and nights, but also has staff working with them. And then there's various levels of group homes. Most group homes have people that are really developmentally disabled, you know, I don't know, Down syndrome, just people that can't really take care of themselves at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think a lot of people think of. But there's a lot of group homes for children that just aren't adoptable because they have a record, because they've been declared a runaway risk, you know, getting declared a runaway risk. That's like the worst thing that can happen to you. And then there's all these levels of group homes. There's some of them, you might have a group home with really good funding that might have, you know, like a JCB group home in Chicago, Jewish Children's Bureau. They'll have homes with only 10 children, you know, with a relatively good staff-to-children ratio. But the worst kids will go into homes like Lawrence Hall or Central Youth Shelter, and you might have 30 children to a room. You might have, you know, several rooms full of these children, two or three staff members hiding behind glass in an office, and it's just anarchy. There's no, you know, supervision. So even within the group homes, there's various levels and degrees. So some of them are out in the woods. Some of them are locked facilities. You need to ask permission to just go to the bathroom. These are children that haven't been charged with a crime. They didn't do anything wrong.
Mm. You mentioned JCB, which is the Jewish Children's Bureau.
Uh-huh.
And that was certainly a bright light for you.
It was a place I ended up at by a coincidence. You know, I was actually getting kicked out of a very bad group home where I was getting in a lot of fights, most of which I lost. And I was going to be put in this really bad place out in the middle of the woods. And then JCB volunteered to take custody, which is like the equivalent of being kicked out of a junior college and then being accepted into Harvard. So I was very fortunate in that way. What had happened was that when I was locked up, when I was first arrested, I would go to synagogue where we could smoke cigarettes. It was the only place you could smoke cigarettes in this particular facility.
So you weren't Jewish?
I have some Jewish blood, but I was not. I didn't consider myself Jewish. You know, there's Jewish blood on my father's side of the family. But at the time, I definitely didn't think of myself as Jewish at all. And, you know, most people that went to synagogue were black. It's black kids, you know, and we just went to synagogue to smoke. You know, we didn't really care about the religion at all. And but for whatever reason, the rabbi in that group home, that rabbi in that facility, put in the word for me with the Jewish Children's Bureau, which was still a rough place, but comparatively, as a group home, they had so much private funding that it was a much better place. And it was still mostly non-Jews in the group home as well, but they picked me up out of a situation that I don't know if I would have survived from.
Mm.
I mean, I probably wouldn't have gone to it. I probably would have just moved back onto the streets.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Stephen Elliott is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with him about his book, A Life Without Consequences, which is based on his life in group homes in the state of Illinois as a ward of the state, and his life on the streets of Chicago. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's talk with our first caller this afternoon on the toll-free line in Lovington. Good afternoon. Is there a caller there? Doesn't sound like it. Okay. Let me invite listeners to join us, join the discussion. Questions and comments are invited. They are welcome. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Were there other bright lights for you? Were there other folks who really made a difference?
Well, you know, there was a girl that was really important to me in my life that was, you know, my own age. But there was really I didn't have much in the way of mentors, you know, until when I was 16 and I decided I was going to stop doing drugs. I was going to start going to school, and I was going to make an attempt to graduate on time. And at that point, when I did my turnaround and I started doing well, then I met a lot of really great adults that were willing to help me along the way. You know, my history teachers at Mather High School, the head of the Jewish Children's Bureau. These are people that I didn't really know until I turned it around. When there wasn't people didn't look at me as a kid with much of a shot, and nobody made much of an effort to help me. And I was also kind of a, you know, as an ugly kid, I was kind of abrasive, especially when it came to authority. I wasn't very good at that. I wasn't very respectful. And so people didn't really go out on a limb for me too much.
Hmm. What was it that got you turned around?
You know, at some point, I just I was doing so many drugs that my sentences were coming out backwards. My friends were robbing houses all the time. I was getting, the police thought I was doing it. They were stopping me and searching me continually. But I really just felt I was getting stupid, that the world was passing me by. I thought of myself as an intelligent kid. And one day I just wasn't intelligent, you know. I just couldn't, I thought it was funny and I'd make a joke. And I would get my sentence backward, and the punchline would never come out. And I just realized I had to quit doing drugs, and I wanted to go to school. Mm. Once you start doing that, you know, it just kind of got its own momentum. And then people were very encouraging. I got all this really positive attention for what I was doing. The group home was nice enough to stay out of my way. You know, I was working a job where I wasn't coming home till after midnight. But because I was doing well in school and stuff and not doing drugs, they just let me continue to do that. And, you know, it worked out really well from there.
Let's talk with a listener on the road, hopefully pulled over, talking with us from a cell phone on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. I'm just very interested in what you are talking about. I'm going to go out and buy your book.
Oh, great.
First of all, who's the publisher?
McAdam Cage is the publisher of this book. There are, you know, pretty large publisher. You should be able to find the book, I would think, in most any bookstore.
Okay, great. And also, you made a comment about families first. I'd really like to hear a little bit more on it, since you've been in the system, how the pros and cons of that. I'm very interested. And I'm going to hang up so I can listen to you on the radio.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Sure. It used to be in the mid-'80s in Illinois, the state had a policy of family first. And with that policy, it was very official and very clear in terms that the first thing that the state was going to try to do was going to be to reunite the child with the parent. So they were always trying to push children back on these parents that were often really terrible parents, because, you know, you don't end up with good parents, you don't end up in a group home. And what happened, I believe a couple of kids got murdered, you know, by their parents as a result of this policy. And I think at some point they changed it. I don't think that Illinois officially has a family-first policy in place anymore. But it used to, and it was really detrimental to a lot of people, because the obvious policy is children first, right? The first policy of the Department of Children and Family Services should be to do what's best for the child. And if that means going back home with the parents, then that's a judgment call. But you should not put the family above the child. The state and the organization should be there to help the children. Mm. So that was a big tragedy.
Yeah. What were the years you were in the system?
I was in the system, I guess, from 1987 or 80, no, 1986 through 1990. Mm. Sounds about right. Maybe 85.
Because you graduated from the U of I in 94,
right?
Correct. So you would have been,
started U of I in 1990.
Yeah, about 18. Then you would have been out of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What happens with kids? Do they turn 18 and then?
Often they're just pushed right out of the homes. Some kids, if they know what they're doing, they have these things called independent living programs. So kids will hook into these, and the state or some private organization will pay their rent for, you know, their first 6 months of independence or whatever. But essentially, they're put adrift. It's one of the tragedies for these children, because what the family offers a child is a safety net. You know, a child is always going to make a number of mistakes. Any person is going to make a number of mistakes, and the family is supposed to operate as a safety net for people when they make mistakes, so they can bounce back. But wards of the court don't get opportunities to make mistakes. And they're kicked out of the system at 18, and they screw up once, and there's nobody waiting for them. There's nobody there to bail them out.
Yeah. You mentioned being a runaway risk is one of the worst things you can have on in your file.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, why is that such a problem? I mean,
well, once, because if you're a runaway risk, no good home is going to take you. So you're going to end up in a locked facility. So that's, you know, primarily why you end up in these horrible places. And you might a lot of other people will be in these places because they're very violent, you know, because they can't get they can't get along with other children and they need a lot of supervision. So you're there because, you know, you're running away from a system that's not treating you right, you know, where they, all sorts of bad things can happen to you. You're probably running. You probably have pretty good reasons for running away when you run away. So it's not an illogical thing to do. And then you're locked up with people that are highly irrational, you know, and highly violent.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to the story you tell in A Life Without Consequences, if you're in a setting and you run away and you're gone for more than 2 weeks, you're really in trouble.
Well, you're staffed out.
You're staffed out.
So you're no longer part of that group home. You can't go back at that point. So that's generally the rule. I'm sure that people have found a way around that, around those rules in smaller group homes if they want to, if the administration wants to. But in general, you know, you get away from a place, you stay gone long enough, it's like you were never there. You don't have to go back. I mean, it's different if you've been charged with a crime, of course. But most of these places are not for kids that have been charged with crimes.
Hmm. Okay, so you're, quote, staffed out.
Uh-huh. That's it. You can't go back. The paperwork, file closed.
So is anyone looking for you?
No, after 2 weeks, they're not looking for you anymore.
What happens if you turn up?
Well, then you start in the system from scratch. But then where you're going to go is you're going to go to a youth shelter. And these are places not run by private agencies. They're run by the state. And it's kind of like an emergency placement. And you'll go in these places, and these are horrible places. And you'll stay there until they find a place that will take you in. Again, if you're a runaway risk, that's going to be really hard for them. You could end up in a children's shelter for a year, and that's nowhere to live. You don't want to live there.
Oh. What's the situation for children of people who are illegal immigrants who run away, who are homeless?
Well, you know, I don't really know. The people that were in the homes in Chicago were black. I mean, it was almost all black children. I didn't get the impression that I was meeting a lot of illegals. I'm sure in California, where I'm at now, it's a much bigger problem. I don't really know what happens there.
Yeah. I wonder if it's even more invisible. It sounds like it.
It almost always is, right?
Yeah. You lived on the street in Chicago for a year. How did you manage?
You know, I slipped on a rooftop. I got really ill. By the time they caught me, I was, just very ill from sleeping outside. I think I had hypothermia or something. I got where I was shivering all the time. And I just slept on this rooftop, you know, or sometimes on really cold days I'd break into like a boiler room, you know, take some risk like that. At 6 in the morning, the laundromat would open, and I would go and sit in the laundromat until school started. This was 8th grade, and then I would go to school. And that was just what I would do. And, you know, friends of mine would get me food and stuff, but they were my friends. It wasn't that poor of a neighborhood. I mean, it wasn't an upper-class neighborhood, but it wasn't that poor. But my friends were poor, you know? I kind of was with the worst possible group of people. And so none of them would take me in, and nobody had any money, really.
Did the school know how you were living?
Yeah, they did. They did. That's Daniel Boone Elementary School.
And
I hear it's a much improved place now.
They didn't do anything about it?
They
for
didn't.
A year?
No. Yeah, all of 8th grade.
How did you know that they knew?
Well, I mean, everybody knew. It just wasn't a secret. You know? I mean, the teachers would buy me lunch.
Mm. Did they have a social worker at that school?
I don't know. I don't remember. I remember one teacher kind of went out of her way and tried to get me a social worker to come in, and then they ended up contacting my father, who then found me on the streets and beat me up pretty good. And then after that, I didn't want to talk to them anymore. I didn't think I could trust them, you know. And that was the end of that.
Hmm.
You know. I mean, and the police would say, you know, I get arrested by the police sometimes, and they'd say, well, if we put you in a group home, they're going to pull all of your hair out. So I never trusted the system. You know, so I was just stuck on the street. I didn't have anybody really I felt like I could turn to. And I wasn't willing to go back home. And then, like I said, my father moved, so I didn't know where he moved to, so going back home wasn't really an option at that point anyway.
And that hair thing was important to you.
Yeah, they're doing important, right?
So, now, did the police know that was an issue for you?
No, I don't think they knew that.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I had some big afro, you know.
Well, because it was an issue for you because that was one of the things that your father would do to abuse you.
Right, yeah, he would shave my head because he knew, you know, I was into heavy metal, rock and roll and stuff, and he knew that that was the kind of thing that would really, you know, would really depress me, you know. And that's what people do when they're angry. They go for the, they do the thing that's going to get you the most.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener on the toll-free line in Mattoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I agree with a lot of what he said. I have been involved with kids off and on in my work and through the court system. And I think the court system, they're gradually getting better in that they don't always send kids back to homes where they shouldn't be going. But I would like to know, has he reconciled with his father?
Yeah, I have reconciled with my father. In the past couple of years, I'm 30 now. It took a while. But in the past few years, we've been talking quite a bit.
Well, that's
great.
That's great. I'm glad that you have. Have you been able to forgive your father for some of the abuses that you suffered?
Yeah, I feel that, you know, I just don't have any resentment for my father. You know, I think at some point, probably just takes a certain amount of time, and they just kind of go away. And you're, one day you wake up and you're no longer angry at this person. You know, maybe you're angry at somebody else instead. you know, you have girlfriends, you get in relationships, you've got other people to be angry at. And then one day, because, you know, I left home when I was 13, so it's 17 years ago. And I just don't have it anymore. You know, I can't be bothered. I think that we're probably missing something, you know, as far as,
that there was a lot going on with your mother dying when you were very young and your father having to deal with you and we deal with his grief as well.
Right, it was really hard on him. I mean, the problem was he felt that he was a victim, and so we were all victimizing him, and of course the children needed, he needed to be strong for the children. This is parents, that's their obligation, is that they be strong for their children. And a lot of parents don't recognize that until it's too late, you know, but a parent has to be strong for their child.
This is true. Now, I understand you do have siblings.
I do. I have an older sister. She's living at home again. She's with my father, living at home. I have a half-brother and a half-sister, and they, you know, they're like 12 years old and 13 years old. I have, you know, a stepmother.
Well, it sounds like things have come circle for you, Van.
Things have worked out really well for me. I don't really have a lot in the way of complaints, you know.
Are you doing anything particular other than writing your story to help the kids in the system?
Well, you know, I work at a homeless youth shelter in San Francisco through the Larkin Street Youth Shelter, and I run workshops with at-risk children at Youth Speaks, which is a really great organization. And I do some fundraising stuff with CASA, but I don't actually work with CASA because I'm too busy with school and things to really make that kind of a commitment, you know, that requires. But I work with them a lot. You know, I go to their functions.
Well, CASA is a great organization.
Yeah.
I've worked with some great volunteers that have been involved with the children that I've been involved with.
Yeah, they're great.
I'm glad you wrote your book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Questions and comments are invited. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Stephen Elliott is our guest this afternoon. He ran away from an abusive father when he was 13. He spent several years as a ward of the state of Illinois, moving from group home to group home. At the age of 16, he decided to turn his life around. He got into a mainstream high school and went on to the University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign, then to Northwestern University, where he earned his master's degree. Last year, he was awarded a Stegner Fellowship at Stanford University. The two-year fellowship is offered to writers in fiction and poetry. Stephen Elliott is the author of a book based on his experiences, the title, A Life Without Consequences. The book is a work of fiction about kids living in institutions and group homes in Illinois. It's his second novel. The first, Jones Inn, was published by Boneyard Press.
And the third one coming out.
Do you have, when will it be out? What's the title?
called What It Means to Love You,
mm-hmm.
and that'll be out this fall.
And it's a love story?
It's a love story. It's kind of set on the streets of Chicago. It still has a lot to do with homeless children, but it's about adults, you know.
People who were in the system or who were homeless?
It's about runaways,
yeah.
You know, but it's as they're in their early 20s or early 30s, you know. It's set a lot in the male strip clubs. There's a runaway prostitute in there, and it's kind of like the next step. It's what happens. It's where a lot of children go as when they leave the system.
Hmm.
And it's about, and, you know, it's a love story. It has a lot to do with obsession and the reasons people do things, you know, the reasons a guy would dance in a gay club for not very much money when he's straight, you know. These kind of things, you know, that people end up doing and what the motivations are.
Survivor tales.
Yeah, tales about need. But I'm pretty excited about that book.
Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line one, a caller. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just wanted to say, in support of what you were saying, it touched a chord in me because I teach writing at the university, and last semester, just by chance, I had two kids in my class who'd been in the system, and they wrote about their experiences. Mm. And for the other kids in the class and for me, it was a real eye-opener. And one girl wrote a story about a day when she was in court, allowed to sit in court, but not supposed to speak.
Uh-huh.
And she couldn't help it, you know. She
right.
blurted out, you know, it's not true what my mother's lawyer's saying, and I don't want to go back to her. And she was physically grabbed and pulled out of the court, and this wasn't that long ago.
Uh-huh.
I think she was a freshman at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was, you know, taken into a room and yelled at. And then she was pulled back out into the courtroom and made to apologize to the judge for her outburst.
Terrible. Horrible.
It really was. So I was just going to say, too, that I'm so glad to hear about your book, and I'm hoping I'll run into these students again, and I'm going to recommend it to them.
The university kids?
Yeah. They were here at University of Illinois, and they very courageously wrote some stories about their experiences.
That's great. Are you a professor there?
Yeah, I teach writing there.
Mm-hmm.
I had another student in the same class who was able to, I guess at a certain point, you can petition the court to be in charge of yourself.
Right, yeah.
And he successfully did that and successfully got into the university. And
that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it really was. So that was my first experience hearing those stories from young people, but they really made an impression on me, and so thanks for writing about them.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Uh-huh.
Thanks
Bye.
For the call this afternoon. Their calls are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana, anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Since that last caller was a teacher, I wanted to ask you about the scene in A Life Without Consequences when you are in, well, Paul is in a mainstream high school English class and the teacher asks him to talk about the reading assignment, Franz Kafka's novel, The Trial. Is this something that happened to you?
No, not exactly.
No, not exactly. Okay. It's a really great scene. Page 142, if you got the book there, maybe you'd just read that. It's about a paragraph long. It's a long paragraph, but it's, you know, it's like, wow, I remember reading The Trial, and I didn't have near as good as understanding as Paul did, you know, at the time in high school.
It's a book that I really related to a lot when I was in high school.
Mm.
In English class, Mrs. Roman asks me what happened to my mouth, and I tell her I am tired of talking about it, and I see Pete laugh a little in his seat, and Jessica gives him an elbow in the ribs. This is not over. Mrs. Roman asks me if I have read the book. I say that I have. The book is The Trial by Franz Kafka. I start to talk about it. I can hear the silence. I can hear the class listening. I talk about Joseph K. I talk about the arrest and the priest stooped under the altar. I talk about lessons and sacrifices. I talk about truth and betrayal and climbing a stairway that never ends. No one says anything at all. I just keep talking about this book. I say I did not really understand the artist. I say I was on the street corner last night. I talk about how people get lost. I say it is like this girl Tanya I knew that I cannot find because she is hidden somewhere. Tanya was arrested at birth but never told her crime. I wonder about the tenements, But then I start to talk about the tenements that litter the city and the courts on the top of the building. I talk about just trying to understand, to grasp for one lousy second, and how even that is not really enough, because you forget too quickly. I talk about losing the most important things. I talk about taking more than the minimum, persecution, being chased, being woken up. I talk about courts waiting to see a judge, never knowing who or where the law is, and who is responsible for drawing the line. No one knows what I mean when I mention benches and security guards and coffee machines in the lower levels of the courthouses. No one knows who I'm talking about when I mention Willie and Willie's laws, his kingdom. So I go back to the parable, the man with the keys and the man who would not go in the door and died in front of it. I talk for 15 minutes and nobody says anything, not a word. And when I am done, everyone laughs.
Wow. What else have you read that it really, if you were going to go in and teach a high school literature course, what books would you bring in with you and put on the table?
I was a big reader. I didn't like television. I read a lot of books in high school. I mean, I still do. I still learn on TV. I loved the Stranger. I remember deeply loving The Stranger, deeply loving On the Road. Crime and Punishment was something I related to quite a bit, though I don't think I actually understood it. I loved Nausea. I liked Heart of Darkness, which I studied in a senior AP English class. So these were all, Franz Kafka, The Trial, and also another one of his. I can't remember which one.
The Castle?
The Castle, yeah, The Castle. Right, because the guy was always trying to get to the castle, and he kept going on these winding streets, and he can never get there, So these were all big. And then, I don't know if these are exactly the things I'd recommend to children. Kind of depressing, well, really,
Depends on the setting, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think I related to them.
Yeah, I think it says something about the importance of curriculum.
Uh-huh.
And meeting, kids are individuals, and maybe it makes sense to tailor a little bit to the audience, and so you can grab them.
Yeah, I mean, I know that I didn't like, Dickens and Austen and Eyre and all the English writers, and in fact, I only liked stuff that was, with the exception of Dostoevsky and Kafka. I generally only liked things that were written, fairly recently. Mm.
I would have guessed Dickens would be on the list.
No, I didn't like Dickens. I liked Hemingway a lot. Yeah. I liked Somerset Maugham. Yeah. But then I never read Tale of Two Cities, which I hear is,
Yeah.
But that was also then, in high school, what you're leaning towards.
Yeah. Well, when I was reading A Life Without Consequences, I thought, how Dickensian. Let's talk with another listener before we're out of time here. Caller in Champaign-Urbana on line one.
Hi. I look forward to reading your work. It sounds real interesting. And I'm wondering about CASA. Is that an acronym for something? And that's something that, as I listen, I think I could do, and how I find out about it. And if Stephen doesn't know, perhaps another caller might know.
It stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocate,
uh-huh.
And I believe the website is nationalcasa.org. I have a website as well. It's stephenelliott.com, and you can go there, and there's a link to CASA.
Okay, and Stephen with a V or a PH?
That's with a PH, and then it's two L's, two T's. So Stephen Elliott.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
There's a strong program in Champaign County, by the way, of CASA.
That's a great group.
You should be able to find them quite easily.
Yeah, I'd like to go around the country and just talk to every CASA group. I just think they're great.
I'm sure they'd love to have you. It'd be a great fundraising opportunity, I'm sure, for them. One of the things I wanted to talk with you about that was so troubling to me in the story, one of the most troubling aspects of the story you tell in A Life Without Consequences, some of the adults who work in the system.
Mm-hmm.
How common is abuse at the hands of adults in the system while you were in the system in those years, that 5-6 year period in the late 80s?
It's relatively common, and the reason for that, I think, in a lot of ways, is, for one thing, just the sheer volume. You come into contact with so many adults. A lot of them are only making $6, minimum raise is up, but a lot of them are making minimum wage. These aren't necessarily, your top-tier workers. So they're underpaid. There's a high turnover rate, and some of them are good and some of them are bad. But, you know, the thing about it is you have to deal with all of them, the good ones and the bad ones, and, of course, it's the bad ones that you remember most clearly. There's definitely sexual predators, you know, throughout the system. And there's people that have a lot of issues regarding power and so forth. I mean, it's just manifest. I mean, there's really great people in there too that are doing it for charity, and they're really good and they're really qualified. But then those people get spread thin, you know, because everybody wants a piece of those people. I remember just how hard we would fight for the smallest shreds of attention from these people, you know, the people that had it to give. And there just wasn't enough to go around.
Mm. You know, it strikes me that the title of your book might be "Lives of No Consequence."
Well, it's more ironic, you know.
Oh.
But yeah.
In the book, A Life Without Consequences, you write, there are rules on the street, but they're unwritten and they're always in flux, and it sounds like that's also the situation inside.
Well, that's so true, you know, because there's always, staff is always changing. You've always got new rules. Each person that comes in brings their own rules into the equation, and based on the strength of their personality, they factor into the situations and the various children that, you know, raise or lower the lowest common denominator. And everything, you know, there's these rules that people expect you to live by, but your situation is changing so continually. And you're moving from so many different homes. You're never really sure what those rules are. I don't think you ever doubt their existence. And they just change. They change continually.
And they can be subtle or dramatic.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
There's a point in the book where two of Paul's friends run away, Justin and Maria.
Uh-huh.
And Paul decides to go off and look for them. He gets lucky and finds them. They're warm, but that's about all you can say for their situation.
Mm-hmm.
What keeps a pair of teenagers like them on the street?
Well, you know, part of it's their love for each other. You know, you have these two teenagers who are stuck in a system. They're deeply in love. The system keeps them set apart, but they're not particularly good for each other either, you know. But the places they're in are pretty terrible as well. And they're trying to deal with that, you know, that a lot of what drives them to each other and drives them back out into the streets are their own demons that come from all these years of terrible abuse that they had to endure, you know, prior to entering the system, you know, the early childhood stuff.
Mm.
You know, that's based on two very real people, you know.
Mm.
A couple of people that, I don't know if these people ever really had much of a chance.
I also got a sense at this point in the story that the streets still had a pull on Paul. That he was staying out as long as he could without jeopardizing his situation.
Yeah, and for me that's always been a fascination for sure. I always feel that kind of pull, and as a child I did. And I know as an undergraduate, it was really hard for me. I was down in Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, and I was always, every weekend I would go back to the city and I would just kind of lounge out on the street corners, you know, just waiting to see what happened. You know, it really gets in your blood. It's really, you can't really leave it behind. I've never been able to leave it behind. It runs through you.
Hmm. Was it difficult being part of the university community here in Champaign-Urbana? It's
really hard for me.
Pretty middle class, and it's...
I never, as an undergraduate, made a close friend. There's not a single person that I met. You know, I'm in touch with people that I've known since I was 5 years old, but there was not a single person that I met while in college that I'm still in touch with. You know, I just couldn't connect. I was so angry. And I was so, these people were away from home for the first time, and I thought I was better than them. You know, they were starting to drink, and I had already drank and quit drinking, you know. And I just thought that I was, you know, I don't know what I thought, but it was, I just could not connect. I had a chip on my shoulder. And I ended up with the most terrible group of people, you know, just like, there's this great school with all these great people in it. But I ended up with that one group of people that was really just, you know, horrible. At one point, you know, I had a heroin overdose, and one of them had turned me over and just left me. You know, to die, basically. I mean, I didn't. But these are, you know, that out of this great school, you know, all these great people, these are the people that I ended up with. And I finally came around by the time I got to grad school, you know. I finally caught up with myself, and I made a lot of great friends there. And I have a lot of great friends at Stanford and in San Francisco. And I have a lot of great friends in Chicago that I grew up with.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Wish you the best. And when you're back this way, maybe we visit again.
Yeah, well, you know, I get the new book coming out in October.
Yeah,
I'll be coming around for sure.
Okay.
Live readings.
All right. Sounds good. Keep in touch.
Thank you.
Stephen Elliott has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. It's his name is spelled with a PH, Stephen, and Elliott, two L's, two T's. He's the author of A Life Without Consequences. It is published by McAdam Cage Publishing.